I can't help it. My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I'm burning up. The coach got to go. Okay? I haven't had a drink since July 20th of 1965. Okay. I look around this bunch here, and there's some of the greatest screw-ups and misfits in this room on the face of God's earth. And you're sitting here on Saturday night, sober. That ain't natural, is it? You know? That's not natural. And yet it's the truth. And that's an example of the grace that works for us 24 hours a day. I wouldn't be sober 10 seconds without God's grace, and no one else here would be either. And I hope you know that. Because all of my efforts to stay sober failed. All of them. I busted my butt to stay sober for a long time in many ways. And it all failed. Until I gave up, gave in. And I guess did the single most important thing I'll ever do. And that was read tonight. Concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I think that's the single most important thing I'll ever do in my life. That took some doing. Over in North Carolina, we call real low-bottom drunks alligators, or gators for short. And I'm sitting beside Wayne today, and I realize you have him out here, too. Stand up a minute, Wayne. Stand up a minute. Come on. You notice the low brow and the beady eyes? The reptilian snout, the sneer on the lips, you know, and the twitching tail. Gators are those guys that lay over in the grass, you know, the spread eagle. The eyes roll back in their heads, you know, you think they're dead. And it's miraculous. You can take the top off a bottle of Thunderbird and just move it under their nose, and they sit straight up, just like this. Take a couple of drinks of that stuff, and they're ready to take on the world, man, you know. Next day, they're in the grass again, spread eagles, you know. You know, the book talks about it as being an illness, but it also talks about it being a way of life. I think that's the reason the old-timers gave us what they call a way of life, a design for living, they called it, that really works. And this is a living program, a program of action. Not thought, not feeling, action. It's a spiritual program. Unlike psychological programs, it doesn't focus on me and how I can meet my needs. It focuses, of all things, on others and how I can help meet their needs. As a matter of fact, the book says, you know, my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of others and how I'm going to help meet their needs. That ain't natural. You understand? We got a gator up in North Carolina named Bob. We got him out of the grass. Started taking him to meetings. You know, he'd mumble all the way in the meeting. Want to know what it is? It ain't natural. I'm all OD on this A&A shit. Ain't natural. Man been sober 30 years, he still mumbles. Ain't natural. You know, once a gator, always a gator. That's all there is to it. Now, if y'all came out here for a bunch of wisdom tonight, you ain't going to get it. I've got severe brain damage. Only have two neurons left. Every once in a while they bump together and I have a brain fart. And that's the extent of my deep thinking. Now, when I started getting sober, I started getting smart. When I was about 2.5 years sober, I knew everything. Everything. And I continued the progression from smartness to wisdom to erudition to philosophy, you know. And I ran into an old-timer down in Texas named Bob White. He's dead now. I love him. Loved him then, loved him now. He ain't dead as long as I'm alive. You know what I mean? And Bob is the only man in the world ever called me sugar and got away with it. That's why they called me. First time I ever met the man, you know, he come down off the airplane, he lifts me up in his arms. I'm not a small person, you know. Hugs my neck, kisses me, sits me down and grins and says, "How you doing, sugar?" You know what I thought? Oh, shit. Is this the way they do it in Texas, you know? And it was, you know, and I was all wise and everything. I wanted to impress this man because I looked up to him. I sat down with him one day and reached down deeply into myself and brought out the profundities of my inner being. Bob sat there and looked at me and said, "Are you finished?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Sugar, for a genius, you're the stupidest son of a bitch I ever met in my life." And got up and walked out of the room. I was crushed. That's why he stopped me in my tracks, dead in my tracks, like a good, you know, right cross. And I began to count myself up to see how many I really was. It's a good habit for me. I still do it. Count myself up and see how many I really am. I'm 31 years sober. And I'm not particularly smart, wise, erudite, philosophical, any of those things. I'm just an alcoholic who has learned to stay sober one day at a time. I actually care and try to contribute something to this world and this life. And I try to the best of my ability to give away what's been given to me. That's all. Now, I learned this from some people we call old timers. And I hold these people in high regard. And I still listen to everything they have to say. Because I realize that learning is a process which is never over. I got much more to learn. And they're the ones who are going to teach me. You know, I used to revere them or mock them or put them down or do whatever. Now I am one. I can't do that shit anymore. And I get a lot of respect in my home group. I'll go in there on Tuesday night and the youngest member of the group will say, "Well, that's Puddinghead. Well, you've been off lying this time. Sit down, shut up. You might learn something. I've been sober 2 years calling me Puddinghead. Ain't that something?" I stopped one of them one night. I said, "Wait, when you got 5 years, you can call me Puddinghead. Not until then, you know?" And one of the old timers in our group who takes himself very seriously says, "Why do you put up with that? I love it, man. I love it. That's the greatest respect that anyone can show me. You know, when I love somebody, I pick at them. That's the reason I pick on one, you know. I call my son Abner. His name's not Abner. There's a lady in the group, you know, who tends to forget her name, Trish, you know, and she really does. She forgets. She introduced herself one night as George. And I've been calling her George ever since. I got a pigeon I call Squidge. He said, "What's the Squidge?" I said, "Hell, I don't know, but you're one." His own mother and father call him Squidge now. He's beautiful. He just had his 5th birthday, you know. He's 22 years old. Beautiful kid, man. And I throw these words at him, and he says, "What does that mean?" I said, "Get a dictionary." And Squidge comes to the meeting with his big book and dictionary with a belt wrapped around, slung over his shoulder like he's going to school, you know. He has on his Pink Floyd t-shirt. And his raggedy breeches with his drawers hanging out of them, you know, and them damn combat boots, we used to call them. And he's got a nice upper torso, really built good. You'll see his legs. They're terrible, man. It is, you know. And I love that kid like he was my own son. And I respect him. And I respect what he's done with his life. And he's one of those guys that when you just ask him to do something, they do it. Once in a while, he'll say, "Why?" And I'll say, "That's not a proper question." And he'll go ahead and do it. You know? And I love to laugh. I cannot tell you how many years I forgot how. Except when somebody fell down and hurt themselves, you know. Isn't that something? And crying was out, man. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. They didn't have me do anything profound. I love this program. I was rum-dum. You know, a brilliant scholar, mind you, who went through college, you know, majored in philosophy and history, had a 3.94 average, minored in religion and Greek and English. Soloist with the choir, had my own combo playing in a local steakhouse. Outstanding biblical student. How's that for a drunk? I won every award they had in that school. And when I got to Yale, you know? And they didn't tell me to do things I couldn't do. He told me to do things I could do. Sit down. You know? It didn't demand more of me than I could give, you know? Shut up. Listen. Oh. They didn't dual diagnose my ass when I got here. So my sponsor, I was manic depressive. He said, "You're a dipshit." When I say I'm an alcoholic, let me explain that to some of these new people there. I want you to listen, new people. We're a piece of work. I'm going to tell you that right now. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean I always believe that anything that feels good should be done to excess. If it feels good, overdo it. So I had problems with everything that felt good, you know? I remember when I found out sex felt good. I was by myself, just like all y'all were. Look at that man back there covering up. You see him? I always wondered why so many guys in AA who didn't play tennis had tennis elbows. Did you ever wonder about that? Well, you know, it felt so good when I first got into it that in spite of dire warnings from my mother, about a certain part of my anatomy was going to rot off and I was going to go blind, I figured, hell, I'll keep on until I'm nearsighted. One of my early successes in life. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean I'm the kind of person that always wants to do everything at once and do it all perfectly. I wake up in the morning before my body's even awake, my mind's going, I gotta. Y'all ever try to pee and comb your hair at the same time? Now women may be able to do that. I can do it. When you're 6'3", you're gonna miss something if you try to do that. And I was always a great starter and a poor finisher. Everything I ever did, man, I had full speed ahead, stop, you know? And in my drinking, when I was hurting real bad, full speed ahead. And then I start feeling better, stop, and go right back and do the same thing that made me hurt in the first damn place. It's the keen alcoholic mind. It doesn't sound like a big problem, does it? Until we realize that the program is a program of practice. Practice means follow through. It means you do it. I don't know how many of y'all in here did like I did, make several false starts, you know? And you wait for the magic to happen, because we believe in magic, don't we? That's when we like booze. I mean, it was magic. Well, we found out, didn't we, that magic is illusion. You know, I'd go to preachers and say, fix me. You know, I'd go to church, say to God, fix me. You know? I'd say to doctors, fix me. Psychiatrists, fix me. I dare you. I came to AA with the same attitude. Fix me. I thought, y'all crazy as hell. Man running around there laughing, said, I ain't had a drink in 17 years. Ha, 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 ha. I ain't had one in 17 minutes. I didn't see what the hell he was laughing about. He kept saying silly things. I'm Sam. I'm an alcoholic, been sober 25 years. I thought, hell, don't he know it? Why does he have to keep saying that? I was always a loner, and I couldn't stand being alone. Couldn't stand it. Couldn't stand being with me 5 minutes without some sort of distraction. I did not like my company. In my entire life, I knew that something was missing. I didn't know what it was, but I knew if I ever found it, everything was going to be okay. In other words, I was searching for something when I was a little boy. and had no idea what it was. Like my good friend Johnny from out in California says, it's like I had a big hole in the middle of me with the wind blowing through. And it hurt. There was an emptiness, an ennui, the French call it. I like that word. And I didn't like that. And so all of these are characteristics about alcoholics that most of us will agree with, but which you won't find in a psychology text either. Like when I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean that I live in a body which will not handle alcohol. When I put alcohol in this body sent me a clear, immediate message. Get some more of that stuff and get it right now. Did yours do that? Every time I put it in there, get some more of that stuff, Tom, get it now. What Dr. Silkworth called the phenomenon of craving. Now, our friends, the scientists, tell us that this is because we have a biochemical genetic disorder having to do with the hypothalamic information control system in our brains. I'm serious, you know, that when I ingest ethyl hydroxide, it's converted in my liver to acetaldehyde, which combines with dopamine in my brain and creates tetrahydroisoquinoline, and I lose control. And the funny thing about it is they're right. AA says I'm allergic to alcohol. I like that better, don't you? I can almost understand that. And I'm an alcoholic means I got something wrong with my mind. I got a mind lock. It tells me someday, somehow, if I just handle it right, I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And I try again and again and again and again, and I fail again and again and again and again. And the scientists say, and rightly so, that I have a narcissistic egocentric core dominated by feelings of omnipotence. Intent on maintaining at all costs its own inner integrity. Shit. You know what AA says? When it comes to alcohol, I am strangely insane. Now, this is kind of insanity that does not respond to medication. You get a schizo in there and give him some Haldol or some Thorazine, and he's in the world again, man. You give it to an alcoholic, he'll come back an hour later and say, give me some more of that shit. It doesn't respond to traditional psychotherapy. Because we lie too damn much, you know? I had a doctor try to treat me one time. God rest his, you know, heart. Hey, man tried hard. After 2 weeks, I was listening to him talk. Recording him like he recorded me, you know? Because it ain't that kind of insanity. The insanity from which I suffer means that I've somehow been disconnected from the power I must not be disconnected from. The big book doesn't say that my dilemma is the absence of Haldol or a good psychotherapist. But my dilemma is lack of power. And if I can find that power, that mental condition's going to hurt me. Damn. A goes a step further. Where science stops. Mental, physical deal, that's it. A says, no. We're mentally and physically ill, but we're spiritually sick also. Uh-huh. And once the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. Woo! What in the world is a spiritual malady? I'm an idealist. Any old idealist? Perfectionist. Hypersensitive romantic dreamer. Who's never been satisfied with life or people or me the way it was. Always had to have more. And fear drove me to get that more. And in order to get it, I had to manipulate and use people and con and scheme and shuck and jive and tap dance and all those good things. People don't like it. They came back at me, and a wall came up between me and those people. And I became disconnected from my brothers, my sisters, and therefore, I believe, from my God. And I was separated and isolated and lonely And when you're disconnected in that way, that is what spiritual illness is. And I disconnected me through what the book calls Self Will Run Riot. The actor who wants to run the whole show. I did it. Of course, I thought they did. Now, the AA remedy is so simple, it blows people's minds. So first of all, quit trying to control things. Quit playing God. Give control to God. Examine the stones in that wall that you put there. Name them. List them. Take them to someone else and talk them over to make sure you haven't made a mistake. To make sure you've been real thorough, you know? And then ask God to remove those stones. And when those stones are removed, then you step through the gap that's there. And you make restitution to your brothers and your sisters. And when you do that, you reconnect. And when you reconnect with your brother and sister, you reconnect with God. And when you reconnect with God, the mental part is gone. You have been restored to sanity. That is utter simplicity. Too simple for intellectuals. Really? I don't understand. When the big book was written in 1939, it was reviewed by a person for the Journal of the American Medical Association, evidently an intellectual. And among other things, he found, quote, absolutely nothing of redeeming value in this book, end quote. Over, what, 30 million copies have been sold? 30 languages? 145 countries? More people read that book on a daily basis than any other book in the world except certain religious literature? But there's absolutely nothing of redeeming value. And I'm not going to say, because I'm too nice a person, that that book's done more good than all the doctors on the face of the earth in terms of alcoholism. I'm not going to say that. But it's too simple. I'm trying to explain my sobriety to an intellectual. I have fun with this. You been sober that long? Must be an awfully strong person. I said, no, sir. When I admitted my weakness, I got well. He said, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. Well, you must have fought awfully hard to win the victory over alcohol. No, sir. I surrendered. Well, it don't make no sense. I know it doesn't. What do you do to stay sober? I go to meetings. Oh, group therapy. No, sir, just a bunch of drunks. We get together and talk to each other. We lie most of the time. He says, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. Well, what else do you do? Well, I have a sponsor. Oh, a psychotherapist. No, sir, he's a plumber. That makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. What else do you do? We have this program, 12-step program. Oh, I got it, he says. The great metaphysicians and psychologists and theologians got together and laid you out a path. No, sir, it was put together by a bunch of monks. He's blown away by this time, and he says, who founded this outfit? And I said, a bankrupt stockbroker and a proctologist who had lost his ass. By this time, he's wordless. You ever heard this? God works in mysterious ways with wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. God. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. Those clouds you so much dread are filled with mercy and shall break with blessings round your head. God does work in mysterious ways, but he works in poetic. What is more poetic than that alcoholics should carry the message to alcoholics? You see? And people lose sight of the fact that God's always chosen strange people, man. I'm telling you, you know? I remember reading about Elijah. Man running around the desert naked. Eating grasshoppers. His hair sticking. I never cut his hair, never cut his beard, you know? Probably had ticks and shit, you know. And God chose him. Maybe Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a real doozy, man. Ezekiel's this dude that saw these dry bones in the valley, and they got up and started connecting and began to dance. He looked up in the sky and saw a wheel and a wheel way up in the middle of the air. I personally think Ezekiel was in BTs. I think he had one too many sip of that Morgan David, you know. Moses. The Bible says Moses was slow of speech. That meant Moses stuttered. Now, can you imagine this? He gets a message to go up to the mountain. He goes up there and says, "Who are you?" Big voice says, "I am." And a bush lights up. Right after I wet my pants, I'd have started stuttering too. And can't you hear God? God says, Moses says, "Go to Egypt and get my kids. I want them to come on home." And Moses said, "I can't go." And he said, "Well, I'm going to send your brother Aaron to do the talking, but you're going, you know." And Moses went. And it doesn't do any good to argue with God either. You know that? Y'all remember Jonah? God told Jonah to go to Nineveh, right? Y'all remember the story. Jonah said, "I ain't going to Nineveh." Slipped out and got on the boat and went the other way. Big storm came. They threw him overboard. Big fish swallowed him up. Remember where he spit him up? Nineveh. Now, the moral of that story is very clear and simple. If God wants you to go to Nineveh, your ass is going to Nineveh. I mean, even I can understand that one, Wayne. I had to think on it a little bit, but you know. So if you ever expect people of scientific ilk, the hell will word ain't it, ilk, to understand our program, they won't get it. Unless they become one of us. And then they'll find out that intellect is not worth a drop in the bucket when you're getting sober, okay? Because the spiritual program, the program you don't understand and then do, you do it, then you understand it. Action, 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 action. No matter what you're thinking, no matter what you're feeling, there's certain actions you got to perform if you're going to stay sober, period. Now, I've had a lot of fear in my life. You don't know me in fear. And I had a lot of reason to be afraid. I was the ugliest baby you ever saw. People say, "How you know that?" My mama told me, that's why. She said, "Son, I never saw an ugly baby until you was born. I didn't take you out of the house for 6 weeks. You was on the face of the earth. I didn't want anybody to see you." You know? As I grew up, things didn't get much better. I was one of them skinny little old boys, you know? Shoulder blades stuck out. Man. I'd try to bring my shoulders around and compensate. You know, my chest would disappear. And mama made me wear knickers. Any of you guys have to wear knickers? Or their britches, you know, like Payne Stewart wears out there. Payne's crazy, man. And my leg was this big, and the knicker hole was this big, and it was always falling down. And I hated them. Somebody told me not long ago, said, "Knickers are coming back." I said, "Not on mine, see." And on top of the skinniness, I had freckles. I had freckles from the top of my head and soles of my feet. I had freckles where people have never reported having freckles. I swear, I think I had them internally. You know? And I didn't like me. I didn't like the way I looked at all. You know? And I wanted to be a macho man. And my mama had four big old brothers, you know? They were really macho. And the most macho one was my Uncle Dud. He was a motorcycle cop back in the days when they wore riding breeches and leather spats up to their knees. You know, had a harness across here with silver bullets in it. And a pearl handle 38 set high on his hip, and he smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion, and he squeaked when he walked. You don't get more macho than that, you know? And you know what my macho uncles call me? Puddinhead. Because I had this great shock of snow white hair, you know, and they all called me Puddin'. My son gave me a license plate for my car, Wayne. Guess what it says, Puddin'? Can't keep a secret anymore, you know. And I got to tell you something about Doug. All the time I wasn't scared, is when I was sitting behind him on that Harley Davidson police motorcycle with my arms wrapped around. In retrospect, you see, even then, I needed a higher power. I saw him Thursday. He's 87 years old. He's still the most macho man I've ever known in my life. He almost died several years ago, and I ran up to the hospital. I came running in his room. I said, "You can't die." I didn't say, "Hey, bye," or nothing. "You can't die." He said, "Why not?" I said, "I won't have either." He said, "Okay, I won't die." And hell, he didn't. You know? And he's one of my heroes. And I got to tell you one of my beliefs. I believe we need heroes in this program. I don't mean idols. I don't mean these poor guys and gals because they can make a good talk and we're putting them up on stage and wait for them to do something wrong so we can gossip about them and destroy them. Okay? I mean heroes. I mean the guys and gals that get out there and they do it and they fall down and they get up and they do it again. And they fall down and they get up and they do it again. You know? They carry the message continually. Not just with words, but with actions. They demonstrate. Do you realize how much that word's used in the book? Demonstrate, demonstrate, demonstrate. And I've had a lot of heroes. I wouldn't be sober tonight, but for those heroes, Bob White is one of them. I'll tell you about some other ones, you know? And they're all dead, but they're not. You understand what I'm saying? You know, their message is alive and well today. You know, the guys I sponsor hear about them. Because what they gave me, I give to the people that follow me, you know? I have a friend in Oklahoma been sober longer than God. He's one of them, you know? And he says the sponsor's job to train the pigeon, that's what we call them in North Carolina. We don't call them babies. We call them pigeons. Train the pigeon to be a sponsor. That's the deal. You got to keep that golden thread going, you see. You know? God help us all with sponsorship that falls by the wayside. Matt didn't like me when I was a kid. I don't like the way I looked. I don't like the way I felt. I don't like what people said to me. Now, when people don't like yourself, it's very important that other people do. You understand? And I set out on a mission without knowing it of getting the acceptance and approval of everybody, everywhere, all the time. If I didn't get it, I was hurt. I became a disgustingly perfect little kid. Disgusting. Straight A's in school, man. Sang little solos, you know. Went to the symphony orchestra one time. We were supposed to play a couple of bars. The symphony was, and we'd identify the song. And after I'd identified about 20 in a row, they said, "Tommy, will you shut up and let somebody else identify one?" And you know, everybody would say, "Oh, ain't he great? You know what I'm saying? This ain't what's missing. What's next? This is not it. Where do I move from here?" So even the acceptance and the approval of others was not fulfilling. That's an interesting word. I used to look back on my childhood and I thought it was, you know, sure. I got into blame big time when I was drinking. Y'all ever get into blame, you know? I was a victim. My mama was a black belt Southern Baptist. Who would have breathed for me if she could, do you understand? Who tried to relive her life through me. Demanded perfection of me. And even when I had straight A's, I got a silent message. You can do better than that. Okay? Any of y'all have a parent like that? And you can blame her ass off, can't you? When I was in psychiatric ward, the doctor said, if I had a mother like yours, I'd drink more liquor than you do. I said, right on. He got into my potty training, and I got into it with him, you know? My daddy was the sweetest man I've walked the face of the earth. He's my number one hero. He was so quiet and simple and gentle, you know, and accepting. And one of these days I want to be like him. It's one of my goals in life. Okay? I don't know if I'm going to ever make it, but I'm going to try. And I love you. But I used to look back on my childhood and all I could see was bad stuff, man. It's so easy to see bad stuff. You know that? Especially when you're like me. I'm a nitpicker. I don't know if y'all are. I'd go in the house after my wife had cleaned it, and without even trying to, I'd find a spot where she'd miss dusting. It's automatic, man. If you've got a defect on you, I'll spot it in an instant. I've gotten careful about that, though. Somebody told me, I think it was an old timer, when you spot a defect in somebody else that's outstanding, it's your own shadow falling across that person. Look within yourself and you'll find that exact defect. I ain't like that shit. Well, I played victim real good, didn't y'all? Huh? Doctor gave me Thorazine. I learned Thorazine shuffle. Walk up and down the hall 24 hours a day. Ain't going nowhere, ain't coming from nowhere. You're just shuffling, man. See, the very insane thing about it is I even excelled at being crazy. I studied the schizos, man. And I started doing what they's doing. They got better medicine than I did. And I studied the manic depressives, you know, and I'd watch them come back in shock treatment like this, you know. I asked the doctor, can I have that? You used to play ping pong with a Cherokee Indian, man, schizophrenic, cat a time. Stand up there and say, never said a word, never had an expression on his face, you know. And the doctor said, you're going to play with him, he may break out one time, he's going to be bad, man. He said, why do you keep playing with him? I said, because I can't beat him. Isn't that something? You know how I got kicked out of the psycho ward? I slept out one night and got drunk and came back and jerked that Cherokee out of bed and I beat the shit out of him. Now, let me tell you what the doctor told me. You have to leave. I cannot help you. Listen, I love you too much. I don't know why people love us like they do. You know what I mean? Isn't it something for Shrimp to tell you? I love you too much. Victimhood's a growth industry in this country right now. Have you noticed? And I know the victim is horrible. But I've learned in the spiritual way of life that I will remain a victim until I forgive the one that victimized me. That doesn't mean I have to understand them, I have to like them, I have to justify what they did. I learned a lot about forgiveness from a friend of mine at home. His name was Tom. Him and his wife came to the program at one time, and you know, and she started running around with another man in the program. You know, we do that in here sometimes, you know? We don't talk about it much. And Tom was going to kill it. Tom come to meet him with a 38 in his pocket. Cartridges in the other pocket. His britches always about down to his damn knees carrying that gun. Go kill that man. And he went to a sponsor. His sponsor said, pray for him. Hell no. Forgive him. I ain't forgiving him. You know? And he hated it, and he hated it, and he hated it until it was eating him up. And one night he got down on his knees, and this is the point. Here was his prayer. Lord, if you have a mind to bless that sorry son of a bitch, I won't object. Amen. Now, does that mean he understood him? Huh? Justified what he was doing or like him? No. That's a misconception we have about forgiveness. Forgiveness releases me. The Buddha was so smart. Buddha said, free your enemy and free yourself. He dead right. Dead right. I had a pretty good childhood when I really started looking back on it, you know? Had a good daddy, and mama's a good woman. You know, I put a lot of stuff off on mama. Mama's one of those women that didn't know how to express love overtly. I never saw her and dad kiss or hug openly, you know? I thought, well, they had sex twice in their lives, once for my sister and once for me. I couldn't imagine mom and daddy getting it on, man. I couldn't. You know, and she didn't know how to do that. And I put her down for all these things, demanding perfection of me and all these things for years, you know? And that's easy to do. Then I realized something. She's dead now, okay? But if I asked her to come to Las Vegas tonight and die for me, she'd be right back. You see, some people don't know how to love us in the way we expect to be loved. And the only way she knew how to love me was give me money, bail me out of jail, almost kill me with her kindness, you know? She was a good woman. Misguided, yes, but a good woman. And I lived in a little textile mill town down in North Carolina, and I had a nice extended family on that side of the block, you know. I still think about those people. We didn't have the same names, but we were family, you know. I'd eat at your house, play at your house. If I misbehaved, I got punished at your house, you know. And punishment was sure and swift in the mill town. They had a way of putting it to you that was real clear. You do that, I'll whoop your ass. That's just what they told us. And you did it, and guess what? And there was no appeal. Didn't do any good. And that's when I first learned about mama talk. Y'all ever hear mama talk? That talk, it don't make no sense. Mama would be switching my little legs there. Remember, son, this hurts me, worse than it hurts you. I'd think, mama, give me the stick. Well, I remember this lady lived next door to us. Her name was Lena. She's the best cook on the block and the best eater on the block. She's a big woman, you know? I used to love to hug Lena. Man, when you hug Lena, you had a breast in both ears. You know what I mean? And she rubbed me on the head and said, I love you, Puddin'. And I say, I still think about it. There wasn't nothing sexual about it. I don't know what sex was yet, you know? I'd love to do it tonight, man. Being surrounded by warm, fleshy love is appealing to me, you know? And I had some good friends, you know? Their little son, Bill Jr. Bill Jr. is one of those little boys that's programmed for self-destruction. You know, if you was in your car about to shut the door, you'd have to look for him. If he's within 10 yards of the car, don't shut the door, his hand would be in it. You know the kind of kid I'm talking about? And I loved him. And then John Q., you know, we had good time. An old man Lucas would come out of the house and he'd go down to slop the hogs, down at the hog pen. Say, come on, Puddin'. I'd jump in that old wheelbarrow and he'd ride me down to the hog pen and I'd go wading in the creek and catch a few crawdads and drink some clear water out of the creek, you know, and just walk. I was expert at being when I was a little kid. I don't know when I started pretending, but it was pretty rough. And one of the things I totally believe about this program tonight is this. Rigorous honesty means just being. Just being who and what you are. No facade, no mask. Okay? Papa, I am who I am, and it's all that I am. Okay? And being up front of that. I used to go to the movie every Saturday. It cost me 9 cents to go to the movie. And for 9 cents, I got to see a double feature western. Couple of good serials, Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, you know, the original Spaceman. Y'all too young to know about this stuff. You have to watch TBS 4 o'clock on Sunday morning. Go see it. And cowboys are my heroes, man. Wild Bill Elliott. And you'll see Wild Bill. He turned you guys on, I'm telling you. Square jaw, big guy, wore 2 silver 6 guns, turned backwards. You draw on Wild Bill, he'd spin them around and shoot the guns out of your hands. See, cowboys was polite in them days. You know? And Durango Kid and Hopalong Cassidy and my favorite was Lash LaRue. Called him Lash because he carried a bullwhip. You draw down on Lash, he whooped that gun out of your hand. Lash was my favorite, man. And I was watching him at the movies one day and he was up on the roof of the saloon. He had run all the bad guys out of town and he popped his whip and whistled and his horse came running by. And he popped it again and leapt into the saddle and rode off in the sunset, and I swear tears come to my eyes. Damn, look at Lash. And I watched it again and again and again. Well, you got to emulate your hero. So I went home, got me a piece of rope, and went up on the garage. John Q. had a pony named Beauty. I said, go saddle up Beauty. He said, okay. I said, now walk her past the garage. And I popped my rope and whistled and leapt into the saddle. And when I hit it, you could hear me scream in Myrtle Beach. That's one of the most memorable experiences of my entire life. 30 minutes later, when I got my breath back, I started wondering about Lash LaRue. I still wondered about Lash LaRue, man. I wonder if he had some surgery or something. I had fun. And it's a beautiful thing in the program. As you grow, you begin to take on some balance in your perspective, you know. It's part of a spiritual awakening. You know what I mean? Your perception begins to change about things. And I begin to see one good thing, then there was two. Then there was three, and then there was four. Isn't that funny? You know, to balance out the darkness of the night. That's a pretty good job. Yeah? I don't know if it's normal or not. Hell, I don't know what normal is. I never have. I think it means average. Damn if I want to be average. You know? I hated me. It's just felt like me. Okay? That self-dislike was to grow and grow and grow through my life and through my drinking until when I got to you, I hated my guts, but I did not know it. Had my first drink when I was 15. Remember it like it was today. up in Greensboro, North Carolina, in a hotel room. We were on a high school singing trip. You know, I used to sing a lot with the choir. In North Carolina, they'd have a music festival every year. And they called a cab driver, and they gave him $7.50, and he came back after a while, and he had a bottle filled with brown liquid, and the label on it said, "Clean with consumption." And I said to my friend, Egghead Baker, "Egghead, what do we do with this stuff?" He says, "Couldn't." He says, "You drink a water glass of it as fast as you can." Then you drink a glass of water, then you do it again. Man, I followed the next East Street is huge. Stood in front of the bathroom mirror and watched myself take my first drink of alcohol. I can picture it now. Why? God, it was electric. Whatever it was that had been missing all my life, it wasn't missing enough. I felt just beyond good. And my friend puked and passed out. I thought, God, what a waste. And when he was laid all over the floor, I called a cab driver, gave him $7.50, got me a pint of cream of Kentucky. And I was off. I found the elixir of life. I thought, you probably thought the same thing. And at 16 and 17, I was a regular customer at the Wake County Jail in my home. Never remember once being locked up. Remember coming to a lot and not knowing why I was there. My mother, hostess of one of the largest Baptist churches in the city. My father on the board of deacons for 50 years. And I'm making the social pages. Wasn't good. You think that deepened my sense of being no damn good? You better believe it did. Got news for you. Tell you now. If you believe you're no good, that's exactly what you're going to do. If you believe you're going to fail, that's exactly what's going to happen. If you fear something long enough, it will set in motion trains of circumstances that will bring you misfortune you think you don't deserve. I read it in a book somewhere. And I was off and running. By the time I was 23, I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in this face alone due to the wrong thing. Locked up in your mobile chamber. Been in psycho wards, religious homes for alcoholics, where I excelled as a gospel singer this time. Hell, took me 2 weeks and I was delivering the sermons in the place. I always went for the top, man. Why? Control. I love control. Y'all like control? Don't lie to me. Don't sit out there and shake your hand and say you don't. If I pulled the bus of life into this room tonight, everybody in here would go for the steering wheel. If there's any Al-Anons here, y'all would be first.
Let me drive the damn bus. You're drunk.
And I love control, you know. Mama got me an AA. I've been kicked out of psycho ward and left a religious home for alcoholics and was laying up at Mom and Daddy's house drunk. She went down the street, this tiny little florist shop. A man named Simon ran this little shop. And he's very happy, Wayne, this day. And Mama says, "What are you so happy about, son?" He said, "Miss Brady, I've never told you this, but I'm an alcoholic and I'm in AA." And said, "I've been sober 7 years, and they gave me this little medallion." He said, "Miss Brady, if you ever know an alcoholic I can help, you just let me know." Mama says, "Come on, son." And Simon took me to meetings. But I went to meetings, you see, with this attitude. There's 12 steps on this side, 12 traditions on this side. Here's a man up front with a book in front of him. All I have to do to gain control here is to memorize what's there and what's there and what's in that book. And they'll make me president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it was a pattern of my life. You understand? That's the only way I knew how to do things. The control position was the top position. And God had gifted me with enough intelligence or intellect to do it. He almost killed me with that. I'm convinced that the real low-bottom drunks are not the gators. They're the intellectuals and those who are eaten up with emotional religiosity. That's a low-bottom drunk, and I had them both. I could quote scripture so you'd puke. So I memorized it. Oh, Lord have mercy. I can quote large portions of the big book to you tonight. I ain't got to anymore. What a freedom that is. You know what I mean? What a freedom. It is all I have. And so I would quote the book, and I had lots of knowledge sitting up here. You know, I got none of the book. And for the next 7 years, the longest I ever stayed dry was 89 days. You hear me? I can quote it. Somewhere in that book it says something about self-knowledge won't fix it. I miss that part. Because you see, I was different. That might have been for every other alcoholic that was here when they wrote this book, but Tom is here now. I'm different. '89 days. Down in North Carolina, they give away a red poker chip when you've been sober 90 days. I wanted one so bad I'd gone up after meetings and stole them out of the chip box. And I met some of the meanest, ugliest, hatefulest, profanest people I've met in my life. They call them old-timers. And they talk to you in circles because they're stupid. One old boy from Burlington, North Carolina, I'm out there majoring in being a Baptist minister. How you like that? Studying philosophy and reading Plato and Aristotle and Martin Buber. An old grumpy, I call him grumpy. His name's Bill Crumper, and he'd wait for me. He denied that, but I know he waited for me. I'd come through the door. He'd be there. How you doing, boy? I didn't like that. I'd say, I'm fine. And he'd go to cussing and back me in the corner and tell me how I was. That's scary. You know that? The man had X-ray vision. He could see my guts. I didn't like that. He said silly things. Boy, you can't think your way into good living. You got to live your way into good thinking. And I think to myself, you ugly bastard, shut up. But see, I didn't say anything to him because I was scared of him. You understand? That's the way it is with them, you know? Boy, how come they're always running around looking for God? God ain't lost. Ooh, I love that one. And I come to the meeting armed with philosophy. And they'd come around to me at last, always, you know. And I'd say, Aristotle said, and he'd turn around and say, shut up, boy. He's a mean old man. You know? Tried to get him on my side one time. I went out to save a soul. I found a drunk in a log cabin with no indoor plumbing. I don't know if I ever told this before I did. The guy was turning blue, he was sick. Been drunk in there about 2 months. I got him to the hospital. I'm in Prince Bay and on my horse. You know, raked out that place. It was absolutely filthy. And I got a lady down the road. We hosed it out and everything, you know. And I called Grumpy because I wanted him to come to see the wonder that I had lost. And when he got there, while I was going through that stuff in that house, I found a gallon of wine, and me and that guy both were drunk. And Grumpy wasn't impressed by that a damn bit. He shook his head. Yeah, I called him one morning. I always call when it was too late. Did y'all do that? You know, all the liquor's gone, chest patterns off on TV. I believe it's time for hell. And I called Grumpy early one morning. Before I could say a word, he said, boy, don't you ever call me again, Grumpy. He said, matter of fact, don't you ever call me again. If you want to get sober, you know where we meet. And don't call me to come get you. You can walk. And he said, frankly, Tom, I don't give a damn if you ever get sober. I'm a sensitive person. Some of the things I said about him that night are unprintable. And I bless him tonight. And he's one of my heroes. And these heroes, they don't change. You know? Last time I saw Grumpy, he died of bone cancer in New Hanover Hospital in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I walked in his room. I'd been sober 16 years, man. And up came the finger, and he said, boy, you'll never make it. I'm talking about humbling experiences. You know what I mean? And this time I had 89 days, I pasted a red poker chip on the 90th day, and by God, I was going to make it. And I went to meditating. I'd done all the rest of the steps, you know. Meditation sounds like something I'd never done, and so I found out who the best meditators were. These guys shave all the hair off the head and wear these orange bathrobes and cross their legs and sit funny and chant. I'm telling you, I couldn't find an orange bathrobe anywhere. So I had to wear my old dirty chair cloth, blue drinking liquor bathrobe with the cigarette burns in it. You know what kind I'm talking about. Y'all had one. Now, I'm too vain to shave the hair off my head. And I busted up my legs so many times driving drunk into things you ain't supposed to drive in that I could get into lotus position, but I couldn't get out of it. So my wife would help me down in the position. I hurt, man. I'd say, oh. Now, I'm not making fun of this ancient good meditation technique, okay? But I'm an alcoholic. Don't tell me about technique. Give me the results. And I'd seen what these guys could do. Walk on fire. Lay on beds of nails, man. By God, that'd get everybody's attention, wouldn't it? Look at Tom. He's walking on fire. Hey, look at Tom. He's laying on a bed of nails again, man. I wish I could do that. And God, I don't know much about God. I don't think it's necessary because he knows everything about me. Yeah, I got a good relationship with the God that I understand. I just think about him as often as I can and have a little conversation with him. I thank him for that sunset out there. Now, I said, that's nice. I appreciate that. When I make a mistake, I say, God, if it weren't for you, I'd do this all the time. Help me not do this anymore. Thank you. You like it. Yeah? He's got a good sense of humor. Can you imagine him and Peter standing up in heaven looking down at me? And God says to Peter, there he is again. And Peter said, who? And God says, Pudd'nhead. Sitting down there in that nasty bathrobe, I wish he'd wash that thing. His legs are about to kill him. He's hurting. And tell me, Peter, what does own mean anyway? That's the most miserable time I've had in time. Trying to do my way that which is not to be done my way. Alcoholics Anonymous is a system. If I fulfill the conditions of that system, good sponsor, go to meetings, read the book, follow the directions and work the steps according to the directions, it will do exactly for me what that book says it'll do. If I do not meet the conditions of the system, it will not do those things for me. So I know it. I drank on. I did a wonderful, beautiful thing one time. You know, one of those fun things we do when we're drinking? I drove my company car under a tractor trailer up in West Virginia. I was unconscious for 3 weeks, and I wasn't supposed to live, and smashed up my left side, ripped my face off for the second time, broke several other bones, became addicted to morphine in the hospital. I was in bad pain. Lost from 215 to 120 pounds. I left the hospital, not addicted, but using drugs. Went back home to Lexington, Kentucky, where I was living at the time, and went to an orthopedic surgeon, and he said, I've got a new painkiller for you. It's just coming out. This is 1964. It's totally non-addictive. It's called Percodan. Now, I knew the doctor didn't know where all he spoke. After I popped a couple of Percodan, I started eating them. Along with the second half. And I couldn't walk, you see. My leg was just smashed. And so I sat there and took Percodan and Sicanol and drank Tepsicola until I found out that boosted it. I got up to walk, I'd fall down, you know, for 5 months until I was able to get up on my crutches. And you won't guess what I did? I went straight to the nearest bar and got drunk. Now, people looking at that say, how in the world could you possibly do that? This stuff has almost killed you, literally, and you go out and do it again. But I don't have to explain that to our class. It seems logical to us, doesn't it? With our keen alcoholic thinking. And make a long story short, and I took a job as a college professor down in Charlotte, and I was drinking pig. And I was about to leave that job. And I'd become so taken by alcohol, taken by it, that before I got drunk, and I knew it was coming, and I knew there's nothing I could do about it, you remember that feeling? I'd go out and buy my wife and daughter presents before I'd get drunk. It was like making up in advance, and they knew what was coming. It was that bad. And then I had the most cursed and most blessed day of my entire life. I got smacked down by me and alcohol. And I came to on the floor. It's funny how seldom I made it to the bed. And I knew that I couldn't drink, but not with my head. You understand what I'm saying? And I knew, perhaps for the first time, that I couldn't quit either. And I knew it was enough. And by this time, I'm on 5 years probation. I got 2 years on the chain gang looking at me. All I had to do was drink and get caught. I didn't have the first driver's license. I never was supposed to drive again in the state of North Carolina as long as I lived. And I made a profit out of drinking. I walked back to alcoholism. Now, mind you, I didn't think it would. Not for me. Not for me. For everybody else, but not me. I had watched them for so long, you know, go on and grab the sobriety switch and live wonderful lives, and I did what they did, and I wasn't making it. It's like Chuck C. used to say, the turtles of life were passing me by like they're riding motorcycles. It's a hell of a thing. And I went late and I left early. I didn't say anything to anybody, but it kept going. And these crazy people in that group found out that I was walking. And I didn't walk no more. First 2 years I was sober, I went to a meeting every single night. And we have what we call group sponsorship. I think it's disappearing nowadays. You know, nowadays a new person comes in, you give them your number and say, call me. They didn't do that. They said, give us your number. We'll call you. I got 8-10 phone calls a day, man. From people I didn't even know. How you doing, Tom? Just wanted to say, hey, good to see you at the meeting last night. I knew they were lying, but they were talking to me, you know. And every single night a car would pull up in front of my house. And they gave me those simple instructions that I could understand. Get in. You know? I didn't ask them where we're going. I knew we were going to a meeting, you know? And I start to ask the question, shut up. It was wonderful. You know? And I kept going to the meeting. I got to watching this guy in the group, and I liked him. One thing I liked about him was he wore very expensive suits, and he drove a Continental and smoked big old Cuban cigars. I'm not going to lie to you. But the thing that was really attractive about Harry was that Harry, what he said was what he tried to do. Not perfectly, okay? And he had the best eyes I've ever seen there. By God, I couldn't even look at him. He might see me, you know? It was so bright, they just sparkle at you, you know? Hell, I wasn't looking at that. I go, oh, man. You know how you are. You're afraid somebody might see in you. And I went up to Harry one night and I said, I don't want to die. You be my sponsor? He turned around to me and said, boy, I've heard about you. They tell me you're not just an alcoholic. They tell me you are crazy. But I'll help you on one condition. I said, what's that? He said, we will do it, Miles. And I don't know but one way, and it's in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You ready to do that, boy? I said, yes, sir. I said, yes, sir. You hear that? You ever notice how wonderfully brilliant your sponsor seems before you ask him or her to be your sponsor? And then they go stupid on you almost immediately? Well, that's what Harry did. He said, the first thing I want you to do, come to meetings early, shake everybody's hand, ask them how they're doing. I said, I don't want to come early. I don't want to shake their hand, and I don't care how they're doing. I just don't want to die, and why do I have to do that? And he said, you don't ask me why, Tom. You do what I tell you to do. That is sponsorship. A lot of people go through your treatment centers now and they get real therapeutic about you. They think my sponsor's a counselor. Like hell he is. If he is, you better jump his ass. A sponsor's a guide. I have a master's degree in counseling. If I told you to do that, you know, my next question to you would be, how does that make you feel? My sponsor didn't give a happy shit how it made me feel. And don't misunderstand me. Nobody in the world cared more about my feelings than my sponsor. Nobody. He loved me with all of his heart. Him and his wife both, okay? We didn't talk about feelings. Sit on the front row. Why? That's where the incurable ones sit. Don't want you to miss anything. So I went to meetings early and I shook hands and I looked at the floor. I didn't miss anybody. I knew he was watching me and he'd embarrass me, you know? You miss what? And you know, the magic started happening. My eye level started coming up. I saw some ankles. And I saw some shins, you know. And I saw some thighs. Saw some beautiful thighs. And some wonderful hips, you know. I ain't got time to get into tonight, y'all. But you know, I didn't know it was the beginning of a new problem. But, you know. And finally, after I don't know how long it was, I was looking him in the eye, and I realized I was glad to see him. Huh? And I did care how to talk. And they did too. You understand? And whatever it was that was missing me was not missing anymore. I was home, and I knew. You couldn't run me away from here with a damn bulldozer. You're my family. You're my family. Then I started getting sold. The one who wanted great things to happen, you know. The erudite one, the vocal one, you know. People have found it hard to believe this about me. For the first 6 months, all I could do was cry. If you looked at me, I cried. If you said my name, I cried. They'd ask me to read, and I'd cry. I couldn't get through the preamble. And Harry called and get me and said, "Sorry, son, come on, your time will come." Yeah. And one night I got through the preamble. And they stood and applauded. And I cried. And then I picked up my 3-month chip, that red chip. Man, you thought I'd been sober 98 years. Them people went crazy. Called Grumpy, said, "Tom, been sober 3 months." He said, "You're a damn liar." Then it was 6 months, you know, and I was working them steps the best I could, you know, and Harry was telling me what to do, and I was following directions. Let me say something. You can talk to me about your being surrendered until hell freezes over. You ain't surrendered if you ain't following directions. And you see, I didn't even know I had surrendered. If I had known it, I'd have screwed it up. You understand? I'd have run around and told everybody, I surrender, you know? God keeps secrets from us, you know, when we ain't ready for them. Took me about 15 years to realize, damn, I surrendered. And I think about, when's my spiritual awakening going to come, see? Big. I was sitting at the college one day. God, I'll never forget. I was eating a bag of lunch, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, "Tommy, you hadn't wanted a drink for over 3 minutes." And he cried every day. Little nudges, you know, little brushes with God. After I took the seventh step, I'm sitting in a little chapel, you know, down St. Simon's Island in Georgia. And I'm sitting there, you know, and I look up, and behind the pulpit there's a picture, you know, a stained glass window, and it's of the carpenter. Y'all know that guy. It's okay if I talk about him another minute. And there was no cross. I just finished the seventh step. And thought came in my head, said, "Where's the cross?" Next thought, "It's been removed, Tom, and so has yours." Little bitty things for the guy that wanted everything dead. That's the way I had to have it. That's the way it comes. You know? Not to my expectations. And it comes when least expected. When least expected. You know, how many times have you discussed, you know, taking the fifth step in a discussion meeting, you know, and it says, you know, about all these things, you're gonna feel the closeness of God and all these things. It doesn't say immediately. And then you hear people talk, "That didn't happen to me." And after the third step, you know, you get on your knees with somebody and you take the third step. That's the way we do it at home. You know? And it says, in effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once. And some people get disappointed because they didn't feel it right then. You understand? You're such result-oriented. I had a friend at home who said, "Continue. Trust the process. Trust the process." It says it in what was read tonight, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover, people who cannot or will not, completely what? Give themselves to this simple process. Not worth it. Jump in the river of life and let it flow. God, it's so effortless when you let it flow. It's so effortless when you turn that broken will over to the big will fixer and you can make a choice and actually do it. Some of y'all out there probably thought when you got sober the world was going to change. I thought that too. Were you surprised? Wow. A fellow named Emmett Fox one time said, "With a new difficulty of any kind, it's the reception I give it mentally and the attitude I take towards it in my own thoughts that totally determine its effect on me." Chuck C. used to paraphrase it. It ain't what happens to me in this life that matters. It's my reaction and make the difference. The world is the world. We're sitting in a meeting the other night, and some kid says, well, this is nice in here, but what is it going to be like in the real world? I said, hell, this is the real world. This is where we're talking about God and eternal values and beliefs and faith, the stuff of which life is really made. Outside that door is a world of illusion. Get it straight, kid. And I believe that with all my heart. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm nestled in God's arms. It feels so good I can't even describe it to you. You don't have to if you've experienced it. One of them chill bump experiences, you know. It's been wonderful. But life's given me some hard blows. You understand? The last 5 or 6 years of my life, man. I can't count the number of surgeries. I think it's 5 or 6. And then one of them was for cancer. And I was married to a woman that I absolutely adored. And she went off to college, you know. And I was paying her way through college and my 2 kids' way through college. And, you know, all my thoughts of future retirement went right out the window with that. And she quit going to meetings and quit calling her sponsor. And she walked out on me with these words. You're a fine man and I love you, but I don't want to live with you anymore. Started having panic attacks. A goodly psychiatrist started her on Xanax, and that was the death knell. She left, my life walked away. You understand what I mean? I'm an alcoholic. I still have within me the tendency to depend on someone else for the way I feel about me, to depend on someone else for the way I believe about me. I got this gorgeous blonde on my arm, man, and she was beautiful. She was more beautiful inside than she was seen. It was astonishing to watch her work with people that nobody else would work with. And they would get sick. And to see that light go out. And it was horrible. I wanted to die. I actually prayed to God, you know, let me die. I just had cancer, you know, this woman, I was bankrupt, you know. All these things are happening to me, and you know, about that time, my mother got Alzheimer's, and my sponsor got Alzheimer's. It's like I stick my head up, bam, you know. When's all this going to stop? I don't want to live. But I never thought about drinking. Remember that, please. And finally, I guess I'd had enough, and I called a guy. And I said, Buck, I need some help. And this guy hadn't been sober as long as I had. But he's as down to earth as spit. Me and him are different as night and day. And he said to me, Tom, I'll sponsor you if you'll help me. I said, well, I'm not going to be much help, Buck. He said, yes, you will. And I went over there with a list of all the things I'd done wrong to make Lisa leave me, you know. And he said, when you're done with that shit, we'll throw it in the trash can. What did she tell you when she left? I said, she told me to find me. He said, you are. And he said, I don't have a solution to your problems. I don't have an answer to your questions. But we're going to a meeting tonight. I said, I don't want to go to a meeting. He said, that's the reason we're going. And I turned everybody loose that I was sponsoring. I was too sick to sponsor anybody. And he said, you need to sponsor some people. I said, I don't want. I'm incapable of it. Can't you see how sick I am? He said, yes, that's why you need to sponsor some people. And thank God. It took me right back to the basics. 7 nights a week we hit meetings, man. I wasn't talking. I was listening. Half the time didn't want to go. You know, I'm OD on this A&A shit. This is unnatural. I was saying all that stuff, you know. But I kept going, you know. That's the magic of this program. You just keep going, you know. I remember saying to my wife when I started out the door, I said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to, y'all excuse my language, please. I do cuss sometimes. I'm going to a GDA meeting. She said, why? You think it'll help you? I said, hell no. She said, well, why are you going? I said, because that's what I do. Went the next night, same conversation. You think it'll help? Nope. Why are you going? Because that's what I do. Third night, come in with a big grin on the face. No. It's what we do that changes our character, and it's our character that needs to be changed. I don't know if any of y'all had a character like mine where the self-hate was submerged down here, but when somebody would say to me, you did a good job, Tom, I'd give them 5 reasons why I should have done better. Somebody said to me, I love you, Tom, I'd give them 4 to 10 reasons why they shouldn't. You're a good man, Tom? Oh, boy, I'd tear that one up. Automatically, with no thought. And automatic unconscious responses, you know, all what character defects are made of. Get that right. That's a good thing I got with Buck. Because my mother died, and less than 2 months later, Lisa killed herself in a head-on collision. And less than 2 weeks later, a person who's very precious to me attempted suicide. 2 weeks later, another dear friend died, And about 3 months later, the lady I was so close to in AA, I called her my second mother and sent her a Mother's Day card every year. She died. So I wasn't through with the grief when the new grief started. I didn't think ever about taking the grief. I got to tell you, I used to hear an old timer named Tom Powers talk. He edited the 12 and 12 for Bill Wilson. Okay? The brilliant man. And he used to say, what this program gives us is sanity. Everything else, he said, is marginal. And I never understood what he said until that day. You know, it says, even so in the big book, God has restored us all to our right minds. Sanity, blessed sanity. Everything else is optional. And I'm okay now. You understand what I mean? For so long I hid me. I hid that part of me, you know, I didn't want you to see. I was that stage character, you know, that's what you saw. I would never show you the other. And so I stayed sick. And I began to show it in the fifth step, you know? And I began to show it to more people as I lived my life. And I began to be very open with the people that I sponsored and everything else. And more of it came out. And today, you know, I'm happy with me. I got a light side and a dark side. Somebody said to me not long ago, some people think you're a saint, and some people think you're a son of a bitch. Which one are you? I said, both of them. And that's okay. You understand? Because I believe in accepting the dark, God has a chance to work on me. And the light will gradually outgrow the dark. Nothing's been added. Nothing's been taken away. I'm still me. But I became a totally different person. How different? When I was 18 years old, the judge gave me an option of going to prison or going to the service. And I got patriotic in a hurry. And I joined the United States Air Force. And my daddy adored me. And he took me down to the bus, and while he was telling me how much he loves me, he had his hand planted firmly on my butt, pushing me up on that bus. He couldn't wait for me to get out of town. You know? And Daddy died with lung cancer. And it was long, and it was ugly, and it was tough. And I saw strength in him I've never seen. You know? And the day before he died, he turns over and says, son, am I going to die? And I said, yes, sir. He said, when? I said, the doctor says it'll be very soon. Does that frighten you? And he says, yeah. But I learned a long time ago that when you get fear, you give it to God and go about your business. And then he gave me the greatest gift I ever had in my life. He said, Tommy, I love you. You're one of the finest men I have ever known in my life. That's the same daddy that pushed me on the bus. You understand? Tell me that. Not long ago, my son is now in the program for 4 years. Thank God. He got up and introduced me. He said, our speaker tonight is the finest man I've ever known in my life. He's my father. He's my hero. A couple of ladies told me to group not long ago. He's the sweetest, kindest, gentlest man I ever met in my life. He said, when you hug, he says, oh, I let you ooze love. I said, what? You know what I mean? I have two kids named after me. I've got three goddaughters and a godson who I watched being born in February. What an experience that was. God, what an experience. I have a totally new appreciation for me. Oh, God. I'd never go through that for anything in the world. And this little kid up in Cincinnati where he was born, they called me the cool one. I don't know why they called me that, but they nicknamed him the little cool. And he wears his t-shirt around, you know. And I'm proud of that. My refrigerator is covered with kids. And you see, I want to be like them. Because I believe with all my heart that when the carpenter said, if you want to go to that place you always wanted to go, you got to turn around and become like a little kid again, that by God, he meant it. And you look at our program, and it's not a stripping away process, you know, until you get down what's real about you. You know what's real about me? A kid. And so I'll stop my car along the highway and take off my shoes and go out and wade in the mud in the field, and they say, look at that crazy bastard. They don't know how good it feels. I get out in the front yard and I vaporize clouds with my children. Y'all ever vaporize clouds? Lay flat on my back and all the kids around me, all the dogs laying around looking up at the clouds, we're making them go away. And the neighbors are saying, oh, he was sober. You know how good it is, you know? My pigeons don't call me on Saturday morning between 10 and 11 because they know I'm watching the Bugs Bunny and Tweety show. Honest to God. especially Wile E. Coyote, who's one of my role models. I totally understand Wile E. Coyote and Fred Sanford and Inspector Clouseau. I love these. These are my role models, you know? And it's all right. You understand? It's all right. I don't think you're getting that, but it will. You know what? But I'm going to keep on fulfilling the conditions of this system. I'm going to keep on following directions from my sponsor. You know? As long as I'm around here. I'm just going to do it. Why? Because it feels so good. Let me shut up, but I'll shut up in just a minute. My friend in Alabama, one of the most brilliant ladies I ever met in my life, she opens her mouth, sounds like Minnie Pearl. You know that kind of person? And Betty gave me a tape one time by a singer. She said, this thing reminds me of you. You know? And it was kind of a dialogue. And if I remember the words, I'd like to use it tonight to close with, okay? As if it were a dialogue between me and my two daughters and my son and my southern dad and smug. Okay? And my first daughter is named Christy. Christy said, Daddy, why aren't you famous? I said, Christy, I think I am. Because all the people you see here tonight came out here to give me a hand. But their applause isn't what really matters. It's what I can feel from their hearts. And if tonight I made dreamers of some who had lost them or made friends with a few who were scared, or if there's one new believer who came here, a critic, and I told him that somebody cared. And Christy, I always feel famous. Though I'm not seen on TV, I get all the attention my ego can handle doing this live and for free. You see, I do it live and for free. My daughter Frances says, but Daddy, why are you lonely? I said, Frances, I guess I am, because there are a few people that I miss tonight who aren't here to give me a hand. But you know, in some ways, they're closer than the people out on the front row. Because if I'm quiet, I can hear Grumpy's heart beating rhythm, see Bob White driving his car. And there are preachers and poets that I never met, like Bill Wilson, who hasn't gone far. So I'm alone, but I'm not really lonely. I just got a group you can't see. They give me all the companionship my faith can handle doing this talking with me. You see, they do this talking with me. And Jason, my son, said, but Daddy, I think you're crazy. I said, Jason, that's what keeps me sane. I was born with a strange sense of humor to go with a strong sense of pain. And I found that there's nothing so serious that it can't hold its own in a joke. So I may smile at stories about people suffering and laugh about losing my hat and make people think I give talks without answers because I tease them and hide where they're at. But I also like things that are simple, and a smile is the last thing you'll see on the face of this crazy old outlaw, laughing out loud because I'm me. I laugh like this because I'm free. And then my Southern Baptist mother said, I'm not trying to say your religion, it's out of her mouth, okay? But Tommy, do you love Jesus? I said, Mother, doesn't it show? She said, I've been listening to you for an hour, and frankly, I got to say no. Because if you did, you'd be famous. Big concerts and Christian TV. You'd be so well known that you'd never get lonely, you'd never be crazy or weird, but you got to give up giving talks without answers, and you ought to shave off that old beard. I said, I love you too, Mother. But you sure found it different than me. You see, I do my best, and I do it like Jesus, because he did it live and for free. Thank you.